Origins, Approaches and Debates in Psychology. Episode 9, The Sociocultural Approach. The focus of this episode is the sociocultural approach, also known as the social constructionist approach, or sometimes more simply as the social approach in psychology. Social constructionism has played a role in the various challenges that have been made to mainstream academic psychology in the last 30 years. In 1973, Gergen argued that all knowledge, including psychological knowledge, is historically and culturally specific, and that we must therefore extend our inquiries beyond the individual into social, political, and economic realms for a proper understanding of people. Social psychology, then, is the study of how our behaviour is influenced by the presence, attitudes, and actions of other people. Using psychological research methods, social psychologists investigate things like the effect of culture on our behaviour, what happens when we join groups, why we do or don't help others, obedience, and the origins of prejudice and discrimination. Social psychology came to prominence in the mid-20th century, but one of the earliest studies credited to social psychology was conducted by Norman Triplett in 1898. Triplett was interested in the effect and performance of having another person present who was doing the same task. He had his participants wind up fishing reels under timed conditions and measured their performance, first on their own, and then again when another person performed the same task alongside them. He found that some people went faster, some went slower, but only a few were apparently unaffected, suggesting that the presence of other people does change how we behave. A practical application of this is in sports, with the inclusion of a pace runner, because that's been shown to increase an athlete's performance. A central argument is that knowledge is culturally created, and that if this is so, then we should not assume that our ways of understanding are necessarily any better or closer to the truth than other ways. Yet this is exactly what mainstream psychology has done. According to Much in 1995, a new transcultural psychology has emerged in North America as an attempt to overcome the bias of ethnocentrism that has often limited the scope of understanding in the social sciences. By giving a central role to social interactions and seeing these as actively producing our taken-for-granted knowledge of the world, it follows that language itself is more than a way of simply expressing our thoughts and feelings. When people talk to each other, they help to construct the world, and that language is a form of action. Basic principles and assumptions of the sociocultural approach are that we have to look outside of the individual to understand behaviour, because our behaviour is affected by other individuals, groups, and the society or culture in which we live. The sociocultural approach has made major contributions to society in the development of ethical guidelines for research, for reasons that will become obvious later in this episode, but also with studies into conformity, obedience, minority influence and the processes of social change, group cooperation and conflict, conformity to social roles, prejudice and discrimination, and the role of culture in behaviour, including enculturation and acculturation. Major theories include social identity theory and realistic conflict theory. These theories have major applications in understanding things as varied as football crowd violence, obedience during conflict, and understanding why people join cults. We're going to have a look at the research of some key people, including Solomon Asch, Stanley Milgram, Philip Zimbardo, and Henri Tajfel. So the history. By the mid-20th century, psychologists were looking beyond the individual to explain behaviour. Humans don't operate in isolation, and we're affected by the behaviour of individuals around us, just the mere presence of them, and by the groups and the group memberships within wider society or culture that we live. Let's take each of these in turn and see how our behaviour can first be altered by other individuals, then by groups or group membership, and finally by the society or culture in which we live. So let's start with individuals. We go back to the origins of psychology in Wilhelm Wundt. Wundt said language was fundamentally a social phenomenon, in that it's not so much an invention of a single human consciousness, but it must be understood as connected systems of parts that can't be reduced to the actions of individual. He said that all social phenomena can be understood as the summation of actions of single persons. The first major concern of those who called themselves social psychologists was the study of attitudes, and in the early 1920s, American psychologists were keen to apply their knowledge to social problems such as racism and the breakdown of communities and families, approaching these issues through the question of attitudes. Attitudes are defined as a set of preconceptions that are involved when individuals interact. Attitudes can be measured using a Likert scale, which is usually a 5 or 7 point scale designed to differentiate positive or negative attitudes to something by asking the person to place themselves on an agree-disagree scale with a central neutral option. The stuff of legend when it comes to magazine and online quizzes. One of the most famous studies in social psychology was actually conducted by a sociologist called Richard Lapierre in the 1920s. He was interested in the racial prejudice against Chinese workers, which was prevalent on the west coast of America at that time. When he travelled to hotels with two young Chinese colleagues, he compared the reception they got when they arrived with the initial response he got from the hotel when he first contacted them to make the booking for himself and the young Chinese couple. He found that the expressed attitude to his calls and letters usually indicated that the hoteliers didn't want anyone Chinese staying at their establishment. But when they actually arrived, they were all treated very well, and he estimated that they even received above average treatment. Lapierre concluded that what people say, their expressed attitude, and what people do, their actual behaviour, are related in complex ways. He noted that as professional middle-class people, the Chinese couple may not have fitted the hotelier stereotypes about Chinese people in general. Now, this paper caused a bit of a stir with psychologists who were studying attitudes with a view to changing them. After all, what was the point of studying attitudes and prejudices if you couldn't then use it to accurately predict behaviour? It was some 30 years later, in 1969, when Wicker conducted a meta-analysis, which is a review of published studies, and concluded that measured attitudes are a poor predictor of behaviour, showing a very weak positive correlation of about 0.3. As people have been exposed to attitude research, and as prejudice and bias towards people of different ethnicities has become less and less socially acceptable, and indeed often illegal, there's a genuine worry that when people report their attitudes, they're giving socially acceptable answers rather than saying what they genuinely feel. For those researching bias and prejudice in society, this is a real issue. Their findings may not be valid, and therefore their conclusions may be false. This also highlights one of the original questions in psychology. Is it enough to study consciousness? Or do we also need to study the unconscious? The unreliability of findings of studies into prejudice may mean that people have unconscious attitudes that are affecting their behaviour. In 1998, Greenwald et al. Developed the implicit association test, known as the IAT, to measure these unconscious attitudes. We respond more quickly to pairs of concepts that we closely associate together compared to pairs of concepts that we don't. For example, the concept of good is more closely associated with joy, love, and peace than with agony, hurt, and shame. In a study of racial prejudice, these items are paired with pictures of black or white faces. Someone who is prejudiced against black people responds more slowly when black faces are presented with good items. And by measuring reaction times to these different pairs of concepts, the authors of the IAT believe they've found a way of measuring prejudice that's not affected by social desirability. However, like most things in psychology, other researchers challenge the conclusion that slower responses are linked to actual racist behaviour. Prejudice is a cognitive attitude, whereas discrimination is the associated behaviour, and they argue that there is still no accurate way to predict one from the other. We know that other individuals affect our behaviour. Just the mere presence of someone else alters our behaviour, and this has been extensively studied in the fields of conformity, obedience, and the processes of social change. As early as 1932, in the famous beans in a jar experiment, Jeunesse showed that people were influenced by other people's estimates of how many beans were in a jar. Psychologists were also very interested in how and why people conformed. Now, in the case of these beans in the jar, nobody could have known the exact answer, yet people kept their estimates similar to previous answers. Then in 1951, Solomon Ash investigated conformity when the correct answer to a question was obvious in a line judgment task. How would you react if you could clearly see that two lines were the same length, but every other person in the room gave a different answer? Do you think you could stick to your guns and say what is right? Or would you be influenced by the need to fit in with the rest of the group? It's very uncomfortable, after all, to be the only one with a different opinion about something. In Ash's study, 75% of his participants conformed at least once, with wrong answers being given on 36.8% of the critical trials. However, critics of this study point out that it took place at the time of the McCarthy witch hunts in America, where anyone whose opinion was different was denounced as a communist, and this actually had very serious implications for their family, their friends, and their work. So this could be a case of historical bias. So what about obedience? Would you give someone an electric shock so powerful it might kill them, just because someone in authority told you to? Stanley Milgram, in 1961 and 1963, inspired by his experiences of Nazi Germany and the defence of "I was only obeying orders," investigated whether ordinary people would do just that. Nobody expected that many people would go all the way to a 450-volt potentially fatal shock marked extreme danger on a machine. Yet what happened next is the stuff of legend. You could say the results were shocking. Before the study started, Milgram asked some of his psychology students to estimate how many people might go all the way, and they thought just 3% would. When they ran the actual experiment, 65% of the participants did, although they showed signs of extreme stress, and three of them even had full-blown seizures as a result of taking part. You may be able to get an idea now why ethical guidelines were changed after some of this research. Serge Moscovici took a different approach. He wanted to know how few people it would take to change a person's mind. And in a classic blue-green slide study using all female participants, he showed that it was possible for a minority view to affect the majority. This process mirrors the process of social change in society. Think about attitudes towards vegetarianism or veganism, climate change, or even Black Lives Matter. a brilliant film or stage play to see showing all the processes of minority influence is called 12 Angry Men, about a jury deliberating on the guilt or innocence of a young man. And now we come to the study by Haney, Banks and Zimbardo in 1973. More commonly known as Zimbardo's Stanford Prison Experiment on Conformity to Social Roles. He found that ordinary university undergraduates would conform to the roles they were given of either prison guards or prisoners in one of the most controversial research studies ever, where things spiralled out of control to the point that the study was stopped after just 6 days of an intended 14. The physical and psychological violence that resulted was worryingly mirrored in 2003-2004 in the Abu Ghraib prison in Baghdad by the United States military police. Apart from Moscovici, none of these studies would be allowed to take place now because of the harm caused to participants. In fact, the harm was so great that ethical codes of conduct were introduced, covering things like protection from physical and psychological harm, the right to withdraw, which both Milgram and Zimbardo denied their participants, the use of deception, and informed consent. So let's turn our attention now to groups. How are norms, behaviours, and attitudes transmitted between group members? Albert Bandura developed social cognitive theory, also known as social learning theory, to explore how learning occurs both directly and indirectly. We pay attention to those around us and see how they're rewarded or punished for their actions. He called this vicarious reinforcement. He added 4 mediating processes that determine whether or not an observable behaviour will be imitated, and conducted his famous Bobo doll experiments on the transmission of aggression. This is covered in more detail in the social learning approach episode. Another theory that attempts to explain behaviour in terms of group membership is Henri Tajfel's social identity theory. This has been very successful in explaining social identity, prejudice, discrimination, and stereotyping. Social identity theory has 3 elements. The first is social categorization. We categorize ourselves as members of particular social groups based on things like gender, ethnicity, and social class. The second is social identification. We tend to adopt the identity of the group we belong to and follow the behavioural norms for this group. The third thing is social comparison. We compare our group with others to see how well, relatively speaking, we're doing. Good self-esteem comes from a positive comparison with other groups. When individuals are unhappy with their group membership, they might try to leave their existing group and move to another group with a more positive group identity. The ability to move between groups is known as permeability. If individuals are unable to move between groups, this is impermeability, and people may try to make their existing group appear more positive by displaying favouritism towards the in-group. This will help to increase their self-esteem and may result in discrimination against the out-group. This was investigated by Tajfel et al. In 1971 in the Clay-Kandinsky study. Another study worth a look are the Robbers Cave studies in 1956 by Muzaffar and Carolyn Sharif, which used realistic conflict theory to explain conflict and conflict resolution between groups. Moving on to society and culture. We need to start by looking at the origins and dimensions of culture. Generally speaking, culture is what we refer to when we talk about the behaviours, attitudes, and identities that are common among a group of people who claim some form of unity with each other. As humans, we have a basic need to belong, and culture is a solution of how to survive. Cultures are different to each other, with elements of surface culture like behaviours, customs and traditions, but also deep culture. This is our norms, assumptions, beliefs, and values. Deep culture would encompass things like gender roles, respect for authority, and concepts of social identity. With rapidly increasing globalization and migration, different cultural groups around the world have become more interconnected and interrelated. Understanding other cultures and the potential areas of misunderstanding are the key focuses of cross-cultural psychologists such as David Matsumoto, Geert Hofstede, and Shalom Swartz. This area is closely linked to the key psychological debate about ethnocentrism and cultural bias. Cultures are dynamic. They're constantly changing, but they're also fairly stable as generations come and go. Their survival depends on attitudes, beliefs, and behaviours being passed from one generation to the next, a process called cultural transmission. Enculturation is the process by which individuals learn their culture. This could be by observation, formal instruction, think for example about how you learn to queue up, or direct personal experience. Cultural transmission is accomplished through enculturation and social cognition. But through globalization and migration, many people come into contact with or go to live in a culture different to the one they grew up in. The result of contact and interaction between cultures has been studied by John Berry in 2005 and is called acculturation. Acculturation can result in changes to one or both cultures, not only the non-dominant culture. This is an issue because cultural conflict is a growing concern in the world today, as diverse cultural groups are increasingly living side by side with potentially incompatible attitudes, beliefs, and behaviours. It would be useful to have a look at John Berry's 2008 acculturation studies, looking at strategies for cultural change, of which the four main ones are known as assimilation, integration, separation, and marginalisation. Studying cultures from an outside perspective is known as taking an ethic approach to research. This approach allows for cross-cultural analysis and is the basis for the research of Hofstede and Swartz. Other psychologists took a more emic approach, seeking to understand only culturally specific behaviour, such as Margaret Mead in the 1930s. Geert Hofstede undertook research in 70 countries and developed five dimensions of culture that could help to explain patterns of human behaviour across cultures. By 2010, his research included scores from 76 countries and regions. The dimensions Hofstede identified are individualism versus collectivism. This refers to the importance placed on the self and personal goals compared to the needs of a group, whether a person's social identity is more personal or more dependent on the group they belong to. Power distance. This refers to the extent which the less powerful members of a group accept or expect that power will be distributed unevenly. Masculinity versus femininity, referring to the extent to which masculine values such as achievement, autonomy, and competitiveness are valued, compared to feminine values of cooperation and compassion. The uncertainty avoidance index, which refers to the extent to which a culture is comfortable with ambiguity and uncertainty. Cultures scoring highly on uncertainty avoidance exhibit intolerance for ideas and behaviour that are unconventional, and they avoid risk-taking behaviour. The final dimension is long-term versus short-term orientation, referring to the ideas that cultures don't experience time in the same way. A low score on this dimension shows a culture that values traditions and norms and is suspicious of social change, conservative in nature, and looking to the past for guidance. A major area of interest to social psychologists is the effect of culture on pro-social or helping behaviour and antisocial behaviour. For example, collectivism is linked with a positive relationship with formal volunteering. The role of culture in advertising has also been studied. Sue and Barker in 2013 conducted a content analysis of 566 Chinese and American television adverts, rating them for individualism or collectivism and the prominence of tradition or modern themes. They found that adverts aimed at younger Chinese viewers scored higher on individualism than collectivism. Cultural dimensions also have applications in real life. Consider the case of Korean Air 747, which took off on the morning of the 6th of August 1997 with 254 people on board. It never landed. Instead, it slammed into the side of a mountain on the island of Guam, killing 228 people. An investigation found that the crew was well-trained, very experienced and professional, yet poor communication between the flight crew and the cockpit was identified as a major factor in the tragedy. What could have happened? It turned out further that this was not an isolated incident. Between 1970 and 1999, Korean Airlines experienced an unusually high crash rate, losing 16 aircraft in a string of unfortunate disasters. Malcolm Gladwell explores this in his book Outliers, pointing to an unlikely culprit, elements of the Korean culture. Gladwell focused on Korea's high power distance index and the resultant communication problems between the flight crew. The power distance index was even higher for flight crews, probably because of the tendency to hire ex-military personnel who work in a strictly hierarchical way. The cockpit of Boeing 747s is actually designed for two equals working in close cooperation. Consultants were brought in to improve the airline's safety record and quickly found that the flight air crew were trapped in roles dictated by the heavy weight of their country's cultural legacy. Once this connection between power distance and cockpit culture was identified, the way the cockpit worked was reworked to reflect a much lower power distance, which allowed the crew to cooperate more effectively. Since 1999, Korean Air has improved its safety record and is now in line with other major carriers. Hofstede stated that individuals are to societies as trees are to forests. Studying forests is not like studying trees. Forests are far more complex and require an analysis of a complex ecosystem. It would be an ecological fallacy to infer information about an individual tree from the forest within which it lives. And the same is true of individuals within a culture. Just because a person lives within a certain culture does not mean they share the characteristics of that culture. Having said that, Hofstede and McRae, 2004, did find that the cultural dimension of individualism correlated with extroversion, that uncertainty avoidance correlated with neuroticism, and high power distance correlated with conscientiousness and extroversion, and that masculinity correlated with neuroticism. We are more individual, though, than simply being the product of our culture. Thank you for listening to the Origins, Approaches and Debates in Psychology podcast. It was written and presented by Mrs. Lawrence.